Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. We start with the good, and we start with the Ken Cuccinelli campaign. And no, it's not that the polls are getting better. In fact, the polls are getting considerably worse, depending on which outfit you look at. But yesterday on a conference call, Ken Cuccinelli was joined by Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, vice presidential nominee last year, of course, with Mitt Romney at the top of the ticket. And one of the issues that came up was Medicaid expansion in the states. Bob McDonnell, the current Republican governor, has flirted with this. Terry McAuliffe has said that if he's elected governor, that he won't sign any budget that does not include Medicaid expansion. So with the horrific rollout of Obamacare, Cuccinelli is thinking this could be a potentially important issue in turning the tide in the last couple of weeks in this race. But what Ryan said here is very important. He said, in reference to the fact that the feds are promising to pick up 90% of the Medicaid expansion, is, quote, "This is like budget pixie dust," claiming that this money is all of a sudden going to come raining in from Washington and pay for all the things you want to do in state government. It's not so. It's misleading. It's basically gambling with other people's money that isn't going to arrive. And so, Jim, we've seen and been surprised by some Republican governors embracing this. There's a huge fight in Ohio right now since the Republican governor is at odds with the Republican legislature, and the Republican governor got a commission to approve it because the legislature wouldn't. But the idea that the feds are going to make good on this payment in perpetuity, it's a pretty good warning for Ryan, for Cuccinelli, and for anybody who can do simple math to point out.
First of all, it's worth noting the federal government isn't going to make this into perpetuity. At least as the law is written, they'd only do it until 2020. So the Obama administration has offered states is, we will give you a really good headline now in exchange for requiring oodles and oodles of money from you in about 7 years. And it's really not that surprising that some of the John Kasichs of the world have gone with this. And in fact, we're kind of more surprising that more governors haven't done that. So here's what it does. Right now, Medicaid, which covers for the disabled, it covers for the very poor, pregnant women, some children who are particularly young, some parents of low income thresholds, to about, at the poverty level, which is about $958 a month if you're an individual, about $1,900 if you're a family of four. I think most people would agree people making that kind of money are genuinely, genuinely poor. What the Obama administration wanted to do was raise it to about from 100% of poverty level to 138% of poverty level. So now you're looking at people who are making a bit more money, but still, like most people would agree, are poor, making about $1,275 a month if you're an individual and about $2,600 a month if you're a family of four. I feel very sympathetic to people in that situation. They probably don't have many good options for getting health insurance. They're probably not offered it through their insurer. Clearly, they don't have a lot of income, so they don't have a lot of money around to buy it individually. However, the problem is that if the states agree to do this, they are on the hook eventually for massive amounts of health insurance costs and health care costs. Because, people who are poor can require every bit as expensive insurance as people at higher income levels. So basically, the cost of health care is exploding. It's gone up 40% in the last 2 years just for the states without this big expansion. And as the Medicaid actuarial report lays out, you're going to see a very big jump in this in costs beginning in 2014. This is not good. All right. That basically, as much as we would want to help these people, and I might even be willing to do it if the states were flush or if the federal government were flush. Unfortunately, we're not, and not even Virginia, which is in better shape than most, is going to be in this situation. The question now is: does the federal government say, "Okay, we're not paying anymore for states starting in 2020, or they do it sometime earlier on?" This is a very warm and fuzzy approach to trying to take care of people that is going to have very big costs down the road. And I think it's kind of been an obscured aspect of this. The Obama administration loves to tout people who've signed up for Medicaid as if they've signed up through the exchanges. But people who are on Medicaid, they pay a very nominal copay. We're talking like a couple of bucks a couple of bucks for every $10 or every $50 or something like that. Obviously, these people can't be charged too much of a copay because they don't have much money. But basically, this expansion is putting states and putting the federal government on the hook for much higher health care costs in the years to come. I'm glad Ryan is spotlighting this. I am glad that Cuccinelli is spotlighting this. My guess is, though, that most people, because it's far off, people will say, we'll worry about it then, and they'll think of it as just helping poor people. And that's, this is how we end up in these crises with entitlements, because everybody has the very best of intentions, and nobody wants to think that hard about how we're going to pay for it all.
Yeah, this line from the Washington Post story on this pretty much tells it all. Ryan said that the federal government's pledge to fully fund the first few years of expanded coverage and then subsidize most of the program afterwards is a promise waiting to be broken. So as if there weren't enough bad Obamacare news, let's go to the bad Martini now, Jim. And one of the things that the White House promised as it finally admitted the problems with the Obamacare online exchanges is that, hey, we're going to redo some other things, too. We're not just going to actually try and fix this so you can actually navigate the site. We're also going to allow you to kind of shop around before you dump in all this private information, or at least put in very minimal information, basically just your zip code, according to Jay Carney. But there's a problem with that. People are getting really bad estimates from this exchange site, and not surprisingly, the estimates are far lower than what the actual premiums would be. Here's an extended excerpt from a report filed by CBS's Jan Crawford.
The website lumps people only into two broad categories, 49 or under and 50 or older. Prices for everyone in the 49 or under group are based on what a 27-year-old would pay. In the 50 or older group, prices are based on what a 50-year-old would pay. We ran the numbers for a 48-year-old in Charlotte, North Carolina, ineligible for subsidies. According to healthcare.gov, she would pay $231 a month. But the actual plan on Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina's website costs $360, more than a 50% increase. The difference? Blue Cross Blue Shield requests your birthday before providing more accurate estimates. The numbers for older Americans are even more striking. A 62-year-old in Charlotte looking for the same basic plan would get a price estimate on the government website of $394. The actual price is $634.
So, Jim, they're obviously putting out the absolutely best case scenario under all perfect conditions, and then they're just setting themselves up for massive backlash when they, you know, if they were honest, they'd get immediate backlash. It's only going to get worse when folks see the truth.
You know, I had actually said this was the one part of the exchange website that they managed to fix up pretty quickly. Now, all they're basically doing is duplicating what you can get through ehealthinsurance.com and other private companies that basically do the same thing. Of, you know, they put together a whole bunch of plans on web insurance. It is built like, you know, Expedia or one of those travel sites where you plug in some basic information about yourself. You don't need to submit all of your personal information, by the way. You don't need to put in your Social Security number or anything sensitive like that. Just say your age, where you live, family circumstances, are you a smoker? Presto changeo, here are the plans offered in your area, and here's roughly what they would cost. The thing is, on e-health insurance, you get a much more accurate quote. And on this one, they basically picked the settings with the cheapest possible ones, i.e., you're allowed to stay in your parents' plan until you're 26. At age 27, you have to get off that plan. You have to buy it yourself. Well, 27-year-olds, by and large, are pretty darn healthy. And I say that as somebody who's pretty well past 27. as a result of that, people who are 27 pay lower health insurance premiums and rates than people who are further along into their 30s and certainly than people who are further along into their 40s. Similarly, somebody who is 49 is going to have a better deal than somebody who is getting along into their 50s, into their 60s, 70s, etc. And it's such a binary choice of basically you're either 27 or you're 49. And, you know, for most folks, you're going to be in circumstances where you're going to be paying much higher than that. This just further indicates that, you know, this entire website, as Avik Roy had said, is, look, the whole problem is that they don't want to show you the prices. They know that if you see the prices, you'll say, oh, my God, that's so expensive. I'm not buying this. Or maybe you'll even decide, you know what, I'll pay the 1% of my salary fee. It's still going to be cheaper than the premiums and copays and deductibles I'm going to be paying on this one. The problem is you can only kick the can down the road so long for this administration. At some point, people confront the prices. And when they do, they're going to say, oh, my goodness, this is so much worse than it looked like before. Why am I doing this? What's kind of interesting is that this administration is very much the type that likes to peel the Band-Aid off very, very slowly, even though it hurts more, Greg.
All right. If that weren't crazy enough, let's go to the actual crazy martini now. And there had been an anonymous official who has been surreptitiously going on Twitter and making kind of bizarre but also kind of revelatory statements on Twitter about Obama's foreign policy, personal observations of people within the administration. He's now been fired since he's been identified. His name is Jofi Joseph, but he's until recently was on the administration's team negotiating with the Iranians. But his tweets ranged from everything from, I'm a fan of Obama, but his continuing reliance and dependence upon a vacuous cipher like Valerie Jarrett concerns me, to the very petty such as, was Huma Abedin wearing beer goggles the night she met Anthony Weiner? Almost as bad a pairing as Samantha Powers and Cass Sunstein. surprising that he's no longer employed, Jim.
Let's be clear about this. These are obnoxious. These are tasteless. These are disrespectful of one's employees. The White House had every right to fire this guy. If you behave in a manner that embarrasses your employer, then, you know, you're going to find yourself tossed out on your keister. But I do believe truth should be a defense. And, you know, Valerie Jarrett getting to pull the strings, or what the heck is Huma doing with that? These are not the most unreasonable, you know, observations anyone has ever made. You know, still should have done them. I'm just going to say that he's, you know, saying things that probably a lot of people have expressed those kinds of thoughts. Bad, bad behavior on this man's part. I would kind of note, though, so as you said, this is a guy who's, you know, part of our negotiations with the Iranians. Right? He's got a really important job. And apparently for years, he's been, you know, on Twitter making these, you know, snarky remarks about his colleagues. Now, I'm literally the last person on earth who should criticize anyone else for going on Twitter and making snarky comments. Having said that, you do it around your colleagues. Well, then, you know, don't be surprised when everybody, you know, won't speak to you at the water cooler. And then two, remember the cruel old days of the Bush administration, Greg? I mean, we didn't have these things from Condi Rice, you know, Cheney, Hadley, George Tenet. You know, like grown-ups were in charge during the Bush administration. The closest comparison you could get, I'll cite Richard Grenell, who was one of Bolton's assistants when he was at the UN. Richard Grenell is one of the toughest Twitter fighters you will ever encounter. And this guy, you know, just loves to rip into other people on Twitter. But he never did it when he was in the job, because the job came first. His duty came first. And then even though, you know, Grenell has this, you know, scathing wit and he loves to tear people to shreds and stuff, he kept it in check. Because he knew that he had a job to do, and that job was, you know, came one. You don't get to be around and play John Stewart or Statler and Waldorf, you know, sneering from the balcony seats when you're doing that kind of government job. And this guy just didn't have the basic maturity of that. And you got to kind of wonder how many other folks in the administration have this kind of juvenile approach to things. And it's one thing to be a juvenile approach if you're, you know, just some schmo on the internet. But on the other hand, if you're being expected, you're being entrusted with a great deal of responsibility on national security policy, a little bit unnerving, isn't it, Greg?
It certainly is. And for all his haranguing of Anthony Weiner, which, as you point out, much of it is justified, they've kind of run into the same problem with each other. They thought what they did on Twitter could not be, you know, figured out.
Very good. You know, hoist upon his own petard, huh, Greg?
Yes. On that note, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.